Chapter 11.
Breaking news. We're just getting reports that Corellian Prime Minister Dirk Gedgen has been shot dead at a spaceport on Vulptr Deep Core by a Corellian terrorist. Early reports indicate that an armed siege followed the shooting, but that appears to have ended when the assassin blew himself up in his ship on the landing strip. We'll have more on this story later.
HNE Newsflash. Slave 1, laid up outside Keldabe, Mandalore. It was a very interesting news day. Fett had his cockpit monitor turned to the news channel, watching the wheels come off the rest of the galaxy. He'd seen that happen often enough to spot the signs of greater chaos to come. Usually it meant a time of good fees and rich pickings for bounty hunters. Now his priorities had to be a little different, and he waited for a call from the office of Sas Sekili, the Verpine whose job was to communicate with outsiders on behalf of Roche. The Verpine were getting anxious. How any species that churned out that many high-quality ornaments could get anxious, Fett didn't understand. But that was the Verpine for you. Insectoids could get jumpy. And when one got jumpy, the hive mind made them all jittery. Fett pondered the assassination while he waited. He couldn't say he was sorry to see the passing of Dirk Gedgen, but at least the Barv paid promptly. Fett had been betting on him staying in office for more than a few short months before getting the inevitable shot in the head, though. It was indecently premature, even by the standards of Corellian politics. Who had really killed him? Not some Corellian hick waving the flag, that was for sure. Gedgen had a line of would-be killers that would have stretched from here to the core.
"Mandalore Fett," said a voice on the comm.
It was high-pitched, a little above tenor, and buzzed with a faint resonance.
"We noted your return with delight."
"Need someone dragged screaming to your hive, Sekili?"
"Not today, thank you. But we have a business proposition for you."
"I'm all ears."
"Ah, we hear exciting things about iron deposits, which we assume to be true."
"They are."
"And many highly desirable things can be made with Mandalorian iron. We would like to acquire some."
"Happy to sell, when we have a surplus for export."
"We note the unstable nature of the galaxy these past months, which will be exacerbated, we expect, by the passing of Prime Minister Gedgen."
"Yeah. Good times for the arms trade."
"Indeed. But also anxious times for us, when Mercana challenges our markets. And now Chemstor I talks of war with Mercana, which is too close for the hive's taste."
"You pack enough hardware to make Mercana and Chemstor I into their own asteroid field, Sekili. Half their kit comes from Roche. Spit it out."
"We are a literal people, Fett."
"I'm literal, too. Let's all be literal together."
Sekili went quiet for a moment. Fett could hear the faint clicking of his mouthparts.
"Now that you have abundant Beskar, you'll rearm. Roche may be outside of your sector, but the last time Mandalorians had plenty of Beskar, the Mandalore sector became much, much bigger."
Verpine took a little time to explain where they were heading, grinding through each step of the sequence. But they got there in the end.
"You're worried we'll expand all over you," said Fett. "Invade you."
"Yes, it's the specialty of your species."
"We're homebodies now. We like to put up our feet and watch the holovids."
"When you make jokes, the hives become more worried, because you're not a joking man. Therefore..."
It was getting painful, and he didn't want to hear Sekili's character analysis. Fett found it amusing that he hadn't threatened or hinted about the fate of Roche, or even thought much about it. But that had always been part of his armory, as it had been for the Mandalorians as a whole. They had a certain reputation that did the advance work for them.
"Sign a treaty with us, then,"
he offered.
"To do what, Fett?"
"Non-aggression pact. Neighborly mutual aid."
"You have nothing to fear from us, so you'll want something in exchange, because you're a mercenary and..."
"Bounty hunter, part-time. What I want is the mutual bit."
"What can we do for you to avoid being added to your collection?"
"Supply us with exclusive products in exchange for our exclusive metal. We give you our special skills, military strength, and you give us yours in defense technology and quality control. Maybe even joint work on new projects."
"Ah, you Mandalorians have always adopted technology from others. You might forcibly adopt ours now."
"Deal's on the table. You made me notice you. Bad idea."
Sikili was silent again. Verpines had a way of communicating instantly with all hive members through some organ in their chests. Fett guessed that Sikili was consulting the hive.
"Deal accepted. We'll need details."
"I'll get my people to talk to your people."
Fett could imagine the reaction on Coruscant, and Corellia.
"We look forward to a long and productive alliance with Roche."
"We will announce this happy and reassuring news. Good day, Fett."
The good thing about literal-minded insectoids was that they were transparent in their business dealings. No games, no bluff, and usually no skipping out on deals. Fett wondered if he should have talked it through with the clans first, but it was his prerogative to choose Mandalore's allies, and teaming up with the best technologists in the galaxy wasn't going to upset anybody. Not on Mandalore, anyway. It would certainly ruin everyone else's day.
"So people think we're rearming." "We are. But not for the reasons they think. This could be interesting."
He secured Slave One, out of habit, rather than mistrust of his own people, and took the speeder bike up to the woodland where he'd reburied his father's remains after exhuming them on Geonosis. Aelin was laid to rest there, too, but Myrta was clearly still uneasy about not returning her to Khifu. She seemed to see the interment as a temporary stopover. He'd marked the graves with simple stones because it mattered to him to be able to find them again, although he had never been one for visiting graves.
"Not even yours, Dad."
Now he was going to put that right. He had no excuse. He wasn't a galaxy away.
"All the times I've traveled from world to world, all the light years I've covered, and I never called in at Geonosis to pay my respects."
Fett grasped briefly at an excuse in his Mandalorian roots. Bevine had always told him it was the armor that mattered to Mandalorians, not the decayed shell abandoned by the spirit.
"I did that, didn't I? I recovered my dad's armor and left his body. I did that much, at least."
Nomadic mercenaries couldn't have cemeteries, and they couldn't carry corpses with them. It was probably based on pragmatism. But Mandalorians, with few exceptions, like the Mandalores, still didn't have elaborate shrines and graves even here. The clearing in the woods was a peaceful, unspoiled spot, somewhere the Yuuzhan Vong hadn't managed to destroy. Tall, silver-leaved galek trees, centuries old, fringed an area of spongy moss and short yellow grass, giving the spot an air of permanent sunlit calm, even on an overcast day. Even before Fett set down the speeder bike, he could see Myrta kneeling by her mother's grave, staring down at it, with Gesorade, Novak Vevut's son, staring at her. Their helmets were placed to one side. She had a funny idea of romance, that girl, but Orade seemed close to besotted, so maybe he didn't care where he had to follow her. They both looked around and watched Fett as he approached. He tried to avoid crushing clumps of fragile amber ferns.
"Tell me if I'm interrupting," Fett said.
Orade looked up at him and got to his feet.
"Here's the deal. You break her heart. I break your legs."
"Deal,"
said Orade. He had a sharp-featured, pale face and a scrap of bright blonde beard.
"See you later, Myrta."
Myrta looked past Fett to watch Orade leave, and then glared at him.
"I suppose that's your idea of protective concern, Babuir."
"Meant it," Fett said. "You're no use to me when you're emotional."
"So, what did you want me for?"
"Didn't. Just came to visit Dad's grave."
Her nerf-frying stare softened, probably from embarrassment. Weeping together over Aelin just that one time hadn't opened the emotional floodgates and given them a blood-bound relationship cemented by shared grief. It was, and probably always would be, wary and restrained.
"I'll come back later," Fett said.
"No, I was just leaving anyway."
"Okay, let's both stand around in awkward silence for a while, and I'll give you a ride back to town."
For some reason, the one thing that never embarrassed Fett was admitting his love for his father. He didn't care if that made him look soft. People said it didn't, especially if they wanted to carry on breathing. He hooked both thumbs in his belt and contemplated the slight depression in the soft, mossy ground, realizing he should have filled the grave with more soil to allow for settling.
"I'm not doing too bad, Dad. Did you ever have to make domestic policy when you were Mandalore? Or did you just fight? I suppose you know I'm dying."
The last thought caught him unawares. Fett believed in decomposition and eternal oblivion. He'd dealt them out so many times, he knew what awaited him. It was Bevin and his talk of the Manda that had him falling into those stupid thoughts about eternity.
"I knew you were basically okay when you split the Heart of Fire to bury half with Mama," Myrta said quietly.
"I'm not sentimental."
"A real scumbag would have kept the stone intact and sold it."
Fett resented the interruption of his one-sided conversation with his father.
"Maybe if I'd left it whole, somebody could have read the information in it."
He straightened up, arms at his side.
"Are you done here?"
Myrta shrugged, collected her helmet, and began walking toward the speeder. It was an answer of sorts. They set off for Keldabe. There were no straight roads. It made ambushing and pinning down would-be invaders a lot easier.
"What does everyone else do with bodies?"
Fett asked.
"Turn left when we get to the river, and I'll show you."
Myrta seemed to have taken this born-again Mondo thing seriously. Fett had expected her to kick over the traces and turn holy Kifar, like her mother, but she'd jumped to the other extreme. If he hadn't known she wasn't motivated by wealth, he'd have thought she was positioning herself to inherit his fortune. That would have been easier. Right now, he had no idea what her motive was.
"Gedgen's been assassinated, by the way,"
he said, banking the speeder to turn along the course of the Kalita River.
"Heard it on the news."
"Good,"
she said. She was definitely his granddaughter.
"Slimy Shabuir."
"I put the full fee for Sal Solo in a trust fund for you."
"Thanks. You didn't have to."
"No, I didn't."
"There it is."
"What?"
"The grave."
Fett couldn't see anything. Just lush water meadows flanked by rich pasture, vibrantly green even after harvest time. They said the area had beaten the Yuuzhan Vong's attempts at environmental destruction because the fast-flowing water in the meadow and the river carried the poisons away downstream. Even to Fett's urban and unagricultural eye, it looked like rich soil.
"Where?"
"Try your terahertz GPR."
Fett blinked his ground-penetrating radar into life. When he looked at the land now, he saw the variations in density and the pockets of less compacted soil. He also saw clusters of lines and debris so tangled together that he couldn't make out what they were.
"It's a mass grave,"
Myrta said. Fett stopped the speeder, and they got off to look. His boots squelched in the sodden grass. And while it was far from the first time he'd walked on a carpet of the dead, this felt vaguely uncomfortable.
"Lost a lot of people,"
he said. "More than a million. Nearly one in three Mandalorians had died defending the planet." Myrta seemed to be expecting some statesmanlike behavior, so he tried.
"And no memorial."
"This isn't a war grave," Myrta said. "Mondoade usually bury in mass graves anyway. We all become part of the Manda. We don't need a headstone."
The exceptional fertility of the soil suddenly made sense. There was no point wasting organic material.
"Manda."
"Collective consciousness. Oversoul. We don't do heaven."
Fett winced.
"I know what it is."
"And it gives back to the living. You'll get a marked grave, of course, being Mandalore. Unless you choose not to."
"Probably just to make sure they know the old Mandalore won't show up again to reclaim the title."
"Maybe just to show respect."
"Has it occurred to you,"
Fett asked,
"that all this is a rationalization of the fact that Mandalorians were always on the move, couldn't maintain graves, and needed to dispose of lots of corpses? And that it's free fertilizer?"
Myrta took off her helmet, probably to let him see the full thundercloud of her disapproval.
"There's nothing profound that you can't reduce to banality, is there?"
"I'm a practical man."
"We're a practical people."
We. Khifu had ceased to exist for her.
"But there's nothing wrong with seeing the bigger picture."
"Can I opt out of the Manda? I'm not spending eternity with Mantras or Vizsla. Or do we take guests from other species? If we adopt them in life, makes sense we take them afterward. So what about the rest of the galaxy?"
Myrta seemed about to spit something vitriolic at him, but instead sighed, jammed her helmet back in place, and went back to the speeder. Fett pondered how tedious it would be if there really were some existence after death, especially if it weren't ticket-only. The one person he wanted to see again was his father. The rest of the dead, loved and hated, but mostly just unloved and dismissed, could stay dead. He resolved to keep his mouth shut in the future. It had always been the best policy in the past, and meaningful conversation was one of the few things he couldn't seem to master. He took her into the center of Caldabe, following the twisting course of the Kalita, skimming above its meanders and river cliffs. The ancient river had gradually kinked back on itself as it ground away patiently at the banks, and it looked as if one good flood would break the narrow necks of land and straighten the course again. A quick inspection with his helmet GPR showed dried-up oxbow lakes pressed like hoofprints into the land on either side. Until the crab boys had showed up, most of Mandalore had been as it had since before humans arrived, primeval, wild, and still full of the undiscovered. Fett hated the Yuuzhan Vong afresh for ruining that. Novak Vevut, Orade's father, built and repaired weapons. He was in the yard of the workshop that also served as his house, machining blaster parts. Fett shut the speeder down at the entrance, and Myrta slid off the saddle. Vevut pushed his transparent protective visor back onto the top of his head and gave them both a big grin.
"Ah, nice to see you two doing stuff together," he said. "Osee Kir, Fett, are we going to be related?"
Myrta looked at him with a warmth she didn't direct at her own grandfather. Fett hadn't picked up on how far the relationship with Vevut's son had progressed then.
"If Beskar is such a good defense, how come you've got so many scars, Buir?" she teased. "Forgot to wear your helmet?"
She'd called him Papa. Vevut grinned.
"I cut myself shaving."
"With a Trandoshan."
"Merry guess, and I'll make you a blaster that can take the head off a dozen Trandoshans with one shot."
"You know how to turn a girl's head," she said,
and removed her helmet and boots before disappearing into the house. Vevut brushed shiny coils of swarf from the grinding bench. His long, woolly black braids were tied back with a piece of string while he worked, but the gold clips strung along them like trophies still rattled and chinked as he moved. Combined with the striking scars in his ebony skin, they made him look formidably battle-hardened. Bevin said the gold had come from his kills over the years, and that he'd melted it down to make the ornate clips. They made Fett's braided Wookiee scalps look low-key.
"When I adopted Guess," Vevut said, not raising his eyes from the workbench, "we had a hard time accepting each other at first, too."
He rasped glittering shavings from the metal he was shaping and held it up to check the edge.
"And I'd known him all his life. His parents were my neighbors. Just because Myrta's your own blood doesn't mean it's automatic."
"I'll bear that in mind."
"Any objections to Orade?"
"Myrta's well over 13. She can make her own choices."
"He's a good lad."
"I know."
Fett's own inability to cope with partners was no reason for him to have any opinion on his granddaughter's life. But he meant it about breaking Orade's legs. It was a paternal reflex that came out of nowhere.
"I did a deal with the Verpine government today. We now have a non-aggression pact with Roche, provided they share tech with us."
Vevut stopped rasping sharp edges.
"Hey, I didn't even hear us fire any shots."
"They heard the word Beskar."
"I do believe good times are on their way again, Mandalore."
"If you feel like sitting in when we talk weapons with them, your views would be useful."
"Okay. I'll leave my bug spray at home as a mark of respect."
"I'd better tell the clans. in case anyone's thinking of signing up for Chemstore I. The Verpine would be upset about that.
It was a good, relaxed way to run a nation. Fett sent word out via his datapad and waited for objections, not expecting any. Apart from questions like the discounts that might now be available on custom Verpine weapons, the chieftains took the news in their stride. It was as if Mandalorians saved all their passions for two things, their families and their wars. Fett returned to Bevine's farm via the river and paused to look at the vast mass grave again. Most species found the words unmarked mass grave the stuff of horror, the worst possible end to life. And yet Mandalorians chose it. Fett, on the cusp between Mondo and Aruaiti, despite his title, tried to see his people as the Aruaitise saw them, to fully understand the fear just a few million of them could cause simply by existing. Detached, he saw an invading army wiping out whole species, fighting galactic wars, destroying everything in its path. And he saw mercenaries and bounty hunters, unemotional masked dealers in death. The image burned into the collective galactic psyche was one of violent savages, thieves, and looters, whose temporary loyalty to anyone but their own could be bought, but never guaranteed. It happened to be almost completely true, except the bit about loyalty. Most people didn't understand the nature of a contract, and they never got close enough to see Mandalorians at peace. Come to that, not many Mandalorians did either. It was a restless galaxy. Fett resigned himself to existing in no man's land, to Mondo for the outsider, but not Mondo enough for some of the clans, and made his way back to Slave One, which was still the haven in which he preferred to sleep. He hoped Bevine wasn't offended. Worrying about someone else's feelings was a novelty, and Fett knew what Bevine would say about the psychology of sleeping in a spacecraft when a perfectly comfortable home, any number of homes, was available. When Fett reached the ship and unlocked the hatch by remote, he found a message waiting for him. It could have been relayed straight to his HUD, but Jang Skirata did things his own idiosyncratic way. "I see you did right by Mandalore. I'll do right by you." Fett hadn't judged wrong then. He dropped his dose of capsules into his palm and washed them down with a mix of water and the cocktail of liquid drugs that Belwine had prescribed. It was just slowing down his decline, not stopping it. Jang hadn't said he'd succeeded.
"Death's a motivator, not a threat. You've still got things to achieve before you become fertilizer. You'll just have to do them sooner rather than later."
Fett switched on the monitor in his cramped quarters and sat back with a pack of dry rations to watch the news as Corellia went into meltdown, and the Verpine government of Roche announced talks with Mandalore to agree to a mutual aid and trade treaty. Then he took out the black book his father had left him. He'd listened to every message recorded in it more than 100 times, and studied his father's image in it, when he was afraid he was beginning to forget what Jango Fett once looked like. He'd take it out and run the messages again. He hadn't forgotten. Not a pore, not a hair, not a line. But he ran it again anyway, and decided tomorrow might be a very good day to go public on the Besu leak. Jedi Council Chamber, Coruscant, Emergency Meeting.
"This one," said Master Saba Sabatine, "would like to be assured that the Alliance had nothing to do with Gedjan's death. It was unnecessary."
Luke couldn't blame her for jumping to conclusions. It was his first thought, too. And his second was that the GA's agents, or even Jason, had a hand in it. But the assassin had, it seemed, sealed himself in his ship and blown it up. A Corellian-registered ship, scattering solidly Corellian evidence. Luke had seen crazier things than that. It was a zealot's act, and all too common. "There are plenty of Corellians with reasons to want Gedgen dead," he said. Where had Mara got to? He half expected her to stride through the doors of the chamber, carrying Lumia's head in triumph. "But I'll conduct my own investigations." Corin Horn looked up from his clasped hands, which he'd been studying with unnatural concentration. It couldn't have been easy watching his homeworld plunge into recrimination and finger-pointing.
"It's less about who actually did it than who the various factions think did it, and that won't be influenced by anything as irrelevant as hard facts."
"Well, I need to know. And I don't want HNE telling me," Luke said. "Kip, can you monitor the headlines while we're meeting?"
"Time was," said Kip Duran, "when the government of the day used to keep the Jedi Council informed and we didn't have to rely on the media."
Yes, Luke had noticed that the Council was no longer kept in the loop. He returned to the main issue. "So what if it is us?" So far, everyone had managed to avoid mentioning Jason. Kyle Katarn joined in.
"Is assassinating heads of state legal?"
"In a war, I believe it is."
"Fine time for Omus to be away," said Katarn. "If I were the paranoid type, I'd say it was spooky that he was out of town. Location undisclosed, at the same time that Gedgen was shot. Better test him for ballistic residues when he gets back to the office."
"This isn't a joking matter," said Kip.
"Okay, sorry. But it's lousy timing."
Luke thought Neothel had done a commendable job of looking calm and reassuring for the media. It had been a few hours since the news had broken, and the news channels had wheeled out every analyst, politician, and air taxi pilot who had ever held an opinion on Durgedgen. Neothel, quite splendid in her white uniform, was impressive. She looked as if being chief of state was just another job she did when everyone else was too busy. She'd scored a lot of points. And Luke hadn't had a chance to call Han or Leia. That was his next task, as soon as he got out of this meeting. They'd know what was really happening, if anyone did.
"Come on, Mara. Where are you?" "So how does this change things?" Kyle asked. "Who's going to be leading the Confederation now? Is it going to stay a Corellian thing?"
"If it's the Bothans," said Corin, "Force preserve us."
Luke was still waiting for word from Neothel. The Jedi Council wasn't part of government, and while Omus was away, it wasn't getting instant answers. Luke realized how fragile and informal the relationship between government and council could be when different people were holding the reins.
"Just to spice up the mix, the Mandalorians are joining forces with the Verpine."
Kip seemed to be listening to the news via an earpiece, judging by the glazed and defocused look in his eyes.
"What does that sound like to you?"
Luke thought of Fett's dead daughter, Jason's guilt, and Fett's track record. He'd been awfully quiet, worryingly so.
"They're rearming," Luke said. "They said they were staying neutral," Duran said.
Kyle shook his head slowly, brushing specks from his lap in a distracted way.
"Oh, yeah. If my long-lost daughter was tortured to death by the GA's secret police, I'd be neutral. First thing I'd do, walk away and be very, very neutral." you don't have to be on one of two sides to rearm, or even take part in a war, Luke said. Still, nobody had said the J word, but Luke could hear the name at the back of every mind.
Well, we know a few facts.
Kyle counted off on his fingers.
One, Mandalorians aren't exactly heavily represented in social services and the caring professions. Two, they have a brand new supply of that iron of theirs for their war machine. Three, allying with the Verpine makes them the single most powerful producer of advanced weapons technology. Four, I hear they're still sore about getting no help to rebuild post-war when they went out on a limb for the New Republic.
It's not good, is it? Said Corin.
I'm betting they'll step up for Corellia in the next few days.
Fett said to have killed Sal Solo, or at least one of his Mondo thugs did. Where does that leave them?
Luke had heard the real story from Han. Never had he missed the good old clear-cut days of rebellion versus empire, good against demonstrable evil, as much as he had right then. The trouble with taking away the certainty of evil was that its vacuum was filled by all kinds of more nebulous threats, rivalries, and feuds. It became increasingly hard to judge where the threat was coming from. If it hadn't been so ingrained in the nature of most species, Luke would have seen it as a Sith plot. It would have been so much simpler. I think we should offer Jedi mediation to both the GA and Corellia, as far as the assassination goes, he said. I know it sounds bizarre in the middle of a war, but there's war with rules, and then there's war with no holds barred. And we need to... The doors opened, and Mara walked in.
"Sorry I'm late," she said. "Ran into a few problems."
She managed to stop the meeting dead. Luke stared in horror at her face. She had a black eye and split lip. She was holding herself as if her ribs hurt. She settled into her seat in the circle with slow care.
"Ran into an armored division, more like," said Kip, staring. "What happened to you? And where shall we send the flowers for the other guy?"
"And this is after a healing trance."
She smiled, and it was genuine, but there was definite anxiety. Luke could feel it. It was all he could do not to abandon the meeting there and then and go to her. How had he not felt what was happening to her?
"Sorry to interrupt," she went on. "I assume we're worrying about the implications of Gedgen's death?"
"And Mandalorian rearmament."
"Forget that for just a second," Luke said. "Mara, I need to know what happened to you."
"Why, darling, thank you for asking. I'm very well. Just a flesh wound."
She shook her head in disbelief, but it seemed aimed at herself.
"Look, I caught Lumia. She's in a worse state than I am, believe me."
"And?"
"The situation's under control."
"Where is she?"
"I'm tracking her to her base."
All 11 council members were waiting in complete silence for Mara's next words. She looked at the other Jedi around her, gently pushed Luke's unspoken inquiry and concern out of her mind with a firm, "later," and settled back in her chair. Luke couldn't pin it down, but she was in turmoil under that facade.
"It's no good looking at me like that," she said. "I'm not discussing it. I'm not sharing the mission, and I'm not going to take it easy, which I'll bet is going to be someone's suggestion. Yes?"
"Mara hath spoken," said Kip.
"But that doesn't stop me asking where Lumia is and what she's driving."
"Nice try, but go find your own deranged Darksider to play with, because Lumia's mine."
Corin gave Luke a knowing smile.
She's fine.
Mara was certainly satisfied about something, but not so content about something else. Luke would find out later. He moved the meeting on. Can we actually do anything about the Gedgen situation here and now? There was a chorus of a reluctant no around the circle. Okay, then. All we can do is keep an eye on the situation. And I've got a request in with Omis's secretary to see him as soon as he gets back.
You know what happens if heads of state are away when a crisis breaks, Kip pointed out. They take a pounding in the polls, and it's the beginning of the end. Let's make the most of Omis while we can.
Who's friendly with Neofel? They all turned to look pointedly at Silgal. She tilted her head slightly to fix Luke with one eye. Always a disconcerting thing in a Mon Calamari.
Just because we're Mon Cals, Luke, it doesn't mean we have guaranteed harmony. We come from different schools of thought.
You're Akbar's niece. And I bet that counts for a lot with a Mon Cal admiral.
I'll do my best, then.
The meeting broke up, Mara remaining seated. Corin patted her on the head like an indulgent uncle as he passed, and then wagged a silent warning finger. Get that black eye seen to. Luke waited until everyone was well out of earshot, and then walked over to squat in front of Mara and put his hands on her knees. You can't keep this from me.
I head-butted her, that's all. Metal jaw, non-metal head.
If you got that close, how did she get away? Oh, bad question. Luke braced for an onslaught about shaking hands again. I mean,
I think she has a droid with her. Something jumped me from behind, and it wasn't organic.
Mara showed him a discolored mark like a rope burn at the front of her neck.
Whatever it is, it can pay out a metal cable. And she has this weird spherical ship like a disembodied orange eye.
Don't you think all that's a good case for not hunting her alone?
She wants me to catch up with her. I'll be extra ready next time, and there will be a next time.
He'd promised her. If anyone could take Lumia, Mara could. And he knew he had to put his own fixation with Lumia out of his mind, stop it from clouding his judgment. He'd give Mara a little more time, but wondered how he'd feel if she came home battered and bruised like this again. Chasing individual dark Jedi was far more difficult and time-consuming than he'd bargained for. Sometimes he wondered why Lumia and Alima had proved so much harder to hunt and deal with than a whole empire. But that was the answer. The empire, by its very size and pervasiveness, was everywhere. It was hard to avoid finding it. But two Jedi with concealment skills could vanish very effectively in an entire galaxy. It would always be a case of getting them to come to him, or Mara. But you'll be home for dinner tonight, Luke said. Don't spend all night working again.
Believe me, I'll be home, she said. That's where I'm heading now.
I'd better see what Han and Leia have to say about Gedgen, while I hang around the Senate and wait for Omis.
If I'm still sitting at home with a congealing plate of Nerf casserole at midnight...
Okay, dinner at 8. Set in Permacrete. Luke walked down the corridor with her in silence, and she gave him a conspiratorial grin as the turbolift doors closed. He opened his secure comlink and called Han.
I'm not in mourning, Han said,
utterly callous in that charming way he had. Luke knew he didn't care for Gedgen, and never had. It was hard to weep for a man who approached you to kill your own cousin, even if that cousin was a grade-A scumbag.
No need to spare my feelings. He was a headshot waiting to happen.
What's the public mood like over there?
There hasn't exactly been a run on morning clothes, but folks are nervous.
So who's at the helm in Coronet now?
They're slugging it out. For the while, it's going to be a committee job.
Who do you think did it?
The biggest task Corsac has is to work out how to manage the lines of suspects. Not that they need to dig up any. Two different terror groups here have already claimed responsibility for it. Yes, we have them too.
I never realized how divided you all were.
We're never divided about Corellia. Just who's the best candidate to run it.
Are you and Leia okay?
Yes, we're fine. And no, I'm not telling you what we're doing at the moment. Stop worrying.
Luke almost raised the topic of a GA smokescreen. It was fairly common to carry out a hit and set it up to look like another faction to achieve maximum discord. But he thought better of it because it smacked of Jason. And Han didn't need to hear that his best friend thought his son, stranger though he was, had a hand in it. Some things were best dealt with by friends, cleaned up and smoothed over. When Lumia was finally brought down, Luke would spend his time putting Jason back on track. It was the least he could do for Han. Omis couldn't have picked a worse day to visit his doctor, but it was unusual for him to be so reticent about routine arrangements. Luke hoped it wasn't something serious. It was bad enough losing Gedgen, because at least he was a known quantity, and Luke had become used to his way of thinking. If Omis's future was in doubt, too, well, that was one unknown too many.
Coruscant Military Spaceport. Ben sat in the cargo hold of the ship long after the ground crew had secured the landing dampers and the drives had cooled completely. He was almost comfortable staring at the bulkhead opposite, in the sense that he feared taking his eyes off it. If he did that, the numbing meditation he'd slipped into would be broken, and he'd have to think. Jory LeCouf was gone. It was one of those facts he couldn't take in, even when he saw it happen. The guy had been alive and well the night before, even hours ago, and now he didn't exist. Ben simply couldn't feel death. It was more than the biological facts, and he knew those all too well. The former CSF officers in the GAG had regaled him with fascinating stories from the police forensics labs, but knowing how to cause death and what it looked like, and being able to feel a life wink out of existence in the Force, did nothing to hammer home the fact that his friend was gone forever, and that he wouldn't see him again. And all the things that made Jory LeCouf part of the fabric of the universe, someone who mattered, were so far beyond his reach. And it was Ben's fault. LeCouf had died to protect him.
"Come on, Ben. The techs want to start stripping down this crate."
Captain Chevu stood in the hatch, fingers hooked over the top edge of the combing. Ben felt that if he moved, the whole world would come unraveled.
"I'll be along in a minute."
Chevu waited for a moment, and then came to sit down with him. Ben suspected that if he'd been a grown man, Chevu might have been harsher, but he thought Ben was still a kid, too young to be on this kind of mission, whether he was a Jedi or not. In many ways, Chevu was right. But nobody was ever old enough to lose a friend and not feel it cutting through to the center of his chest. If Ben ever got that old, he didn't want to carry on.
"We don't lose many troopers in special forces. It makes it harder when we do, I think. It's hard for me, anyway."
Ben gambled on whether to speak or not. He took a breath and waited to feel everything around him shatter.
"He didn't have to die, sir."
Once he heard his own voice, Ben just felt like he couldn't breathe. Nothing worse.
He could have taken off. We could have run for it, or even been captured, and the job would still have been done.
Ben, our orders were to make it look like a Corellian schism, and not to get caught or leave a trail. Can't have Jedi exposed as assassins, especially not you. We had to get you out of there.
It didn't have to be me. Any trooper could have done the job. I wanted to do my duty, but if it hadn't been me, if Jory hadn't felt he had to protect my identity, he'd be alive.
Ben, what do you think would have happened to him if he'd been taken back to Corellia? Shevu lowered his voice.
You saw what we do here to prisoners. You think worse than that can't happen in Coronet?
So what if I had been caught? My dad would have been humiliated? So what? Jory's life for Dad being upset?
I could give you a list of reasons why having Corellia think their own kind did it helps the GA. But you don't want to hear that right now.
Shevu stood up and beckoned Ben to follow. He meant it.
There are anti-Gedgen factions claiming responsibility. So the mission worked fine, strategically. Now go home and take a couple of days off. If you can't stand being around your folks or around Colonel Solo, come over to my place. My girlfriend won't mind.
It was the first time Ben had heard Shevu hint that being around Jason wasn't necessarily the best thing for him.
Ben didn't care about Jason right then, but the rational bit of his mind that wasn't drowning in shocked grief made a note of it.
Thanks.
Now I've got to tell his parents. I'll have to come up with a really good cover story, and thank Providence that there's no footage of him splashed all over the news right now, because that'd be a really lousy way to find out your son was dead.
Shevu sounded beaten.
He was probably pretty close to Lacalf, but he'd never said. Ben had learned a lesson about being an officer today, and it was that lives were to be spent in pursuit of an objective. It might have seemed obvious, but when you worked alongside the people who might lose their loved ones because of your decisions, it acquired a whole new meaning.
I don't think I'll ever stop feeling guilty about this, Ben said, relieved that he had so far managed not to burst into tears.
Me neither, said Shevu, because it was supposed to be me who blew the ship if things went wrong.
We never planned that you didn't.
We did. Need to know and all that.
Shevu stopped a passing ground crew speeder and told the driver to get Ben back to HQ.
Wash that stuff out of your hair and go home.
An hour later, Ben found himself staring at his familiar reflection in the HQ refreshers, toweling his hair and wondering if Jason had set him up.
I didn't have to do the job. Any one of us could have passed unnoticed at a spaceport.
But it was hindsight. Jason had tasked him to do it before anyone knew where the meeting would take place. Ben still felt something was wrong, but couldn't pin it down. He'd just lost his buddy. Maybe that made you think crazy things. When he left the HQ building and walked out into the late afternoon sun, completely disoriented by the shifts in planetary time over the last 48 hours, he lowered his head and just walked aimlessly, hands in pockets. Suddenly he felt someone's hand on his shoulder. He almost shrieked. He'd shut out everything around him. Then he found he was staring into his mother's face, and something was terribly wrong.
Mom, who hit you?
Forget that, Ben.
She hugged him to her,
a really desperate and crushing embrace. "I've got some questions, and I will absolutely not be stalled this time." She had hold of his shoulders, eyes scanning his face as if she was looking for injury. "This is between you and me. I swear, not your father." They ended up in a tap caf in the Osarian quarter. The table was greasy, and the elbows of Ben's jacket stuck to it every time he leaned on them. But nobody knew them here. Even if the food had been appetizing and not searingly hot, Ben wasn't hungry. Mara lowered her voice.
"I want to know why you've been to Volpter."
Ben was stunned. How could she possibly know? Who'd talked? It was completely classified. Most of the GAG hadn't even been briefed on it.
"I haven't."
"You can stop the game. I know where you've been. And I have a horrible feeling I know why. The whole planet's seen the news."
Mara just stared at him, not blinking. Suddenly not his mom at all. He was supposed to deny everything. He stared back, silent.
"I could ask Jason, sweetheart, but I'm not sure I could believe him if he told me what the time was."
"You know I can't talk about my work, Mom."
"Oh, I know. I've never hidden my past from you, so I know exactly what your work entails. I can talk to you like a grown-up, Ben, because once you do the kind of job you're doing, you're not a kid any longer. Do we understand each other?"
Ben thought of Jory LeCalf and felt his stomach starting to knot and shake. He desperately wanted to blurt out that his buddy had died, and that he wanted to roll time back to before he'd fallen into this mess, and that...
"Mom!"
He couldn't get it out. She put her hand on his and squeezed.
"Mom, if I tell you, will you tell me who hit you?"
"Okay. It was Lumia. I caught her, but she got away. I gave her a good hiding, and she won't get away next time. Now, your turn."
Ben took a deep breath. This was either going to make everything better, or be the start of something disastrous. He couldn't tell. All his force impressions had deserted him.
"I did it, Mom."
"Involved? Or did it?"
Ben's mouth took over without his permission.
"Folding stock Karpaki. Frangible round."
Mara actually sat back in her chair, and her left hand moved as if she was about to put it to her mouth. Her right hand was still clamped tight on his.
"Okay,"
she said.
"LeCalf was killed, Mom."
Ben couldn't remember if she knew LeCalf or not. It didn't matter. He needed to say his name and tell someone.
"Jory got killed. He got killed to save my skin."
Mara busied herself sipping from the cup in front of her. Osarians liked very strongly scented herbs, and Ben knew he'd never be able to smell that aroma again without being dragged back to this awful moment.
"Why did you do it, Ben?"
"Orders. I was the best person to do it."
"Your whole company is suddenly short of snipers? Whose orders?"
"Jason."
Mara was doing a reasonable job of not reacting. But Ben wasn't fooled. She was furious. He could see it in the whiteness of her skin, and the contrast with the yellowing bruise around her eye made it even more noticeable.
"Okay, sweetheart,"
she said.
"Let's not tell your dad, because he'll rip Jason's head off in the mood he's in at the moment. Can you face coming home?"
"I don't think I can sit and have dinner and not talk about this to him."
Okay. So where are you planning on going?
Home? Jason's apartment.
Ben could see she wasn't keen on the idea.
Or Captain Chevu's place.
Wherever you feel safest, Ben. I won't force you to come back with me, as long as you swear you'll come to me the second you have problems. Okay?
Okay.
I'm sorry about your friend. I really am.
Nobody's ever going to know how brave he was.
I know.
Are you angry with me?
Stupid question. You must be. How can I be, after what I used to do?
She gripped both his hands, as if she was afraid he'd run away.
This is what we made you, isn't it? We wanted you to be like us. We wanted you to be a Jedi and do your duty.
Mara was quiet for a while, gazing out the window onto the sky lane packed with traffic and clearly thinking hard.
You still haven't told me how you knew, Mom.
She jerked back to the conversation, blinking.
No, I haven't. But I know, and I'm the only one who does. And I also know you can hide in the Force, like Jason does. And it scares me, because the first time I felt it, I thought you'd been killed. Please, Ben, don't hide from me. Ever.
I wasn't, Mom. I was just trying it out.
Okay.
Am I going to feel bad about, you know, the other guy? Because right now I don't care.
I didn't,
she said, seeming to understand he meant Gedgen.
Not until lately. And then it didn't feel like guilt, just not quite understanding why I did it. Because being what I was didn't explain it all to me.
I'd better go.
You'll be okay. I'll always be there, remember. Call me.
Ben leaned forward to kiss her on the cheek.
He loved her so much right then. What other
mom could take news like that, horrific news, and still be there for him? He leaned farther and whispered in her ear.
He was having a secret meeting at the port with Omis to discuss a ceasefire.
When Ben straightened up,
she smiled.
But there was a real glint in her eye that said she was anything but happy.
Thank you,
she said.
I love you, Ben. Call me, okay?
Love you too, Mom.
Ben couldn't stand it any longer. He walked out of the tap caf and spent the next couple of hours wandering around, staring in shop windows and not seeing anything, before he got an air taxi back to Jason's apartment and shut himself in his room. It was going to take a long time to make sense of this. He slipped the vibroblade under his pillow, reluctant to let it sit as far away as his desk, and wondered what Captain Chevu was telling Jory LeCouf's family.